Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 16, where we discuss another management classic, Contingency Theory of Organization. Specifically, we look at the 1967 article by Lawrence and Lorsch entitled Differentiation and Integration in Complex Organizations. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, speaking to you from the University of Warwick campus in the UK.
And this is Pedro, coming to you from Rio in Brazil, where the Olympic Games are happening.
And this is Ralph, coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico in the USA.
So after a couple of episodes centered on more contemporary stuff, we're back to the classics. And so the topic for today is contingency theory, and our reading is Differentiation and Integration in Complex Organizations, which is, of course, a 1967 article by Paul Lawrence and Jay Lorsch, also known as Lawrence and Lorsch, a crime-fighting duo with a formidable eye for detail and irresistible charm with the ladies. Out on the mean streets to save the day, contingent on the environmental conditions, of course.
Of course.
I don't know. But it would have been cool if that were their alter ego.
But, right. Yeah.
Indeed.
I'm trying to imagine their costumes right now.
I was thinking Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, okay. I was thinking more like Batman and Robin myself.
Who's who?
Oh, I think Lawrence is Batman and Lorsch is Robin.
I have no frame of reference, so I'm just going to take your word for it.
Okay. Well, it's on anybody who wants to can look up YouTube, the one Batman and Robin. I'm sure they have episodes with Adam West. That was a very campy, high-color version on television in the United States in the 1960s.
Anyway, let's summarize this paper that would be known, I would imagine, to anyone who has taken an undergraduate course in management, because it's just so key. So the paper covers a number of things. There are three main principles so the first one is that organizational performance is determined by the organization's ability to cope with its environment. The second is the degree of differentiation into subsystems is based on environmental requirements. And we'll go through the terminology shortly. And each subsystem selectively adapts to that part of the environment that it deals with, essentially. And the third one is that the degree of integration is consistent with the requirements of the environment. So to simplify that, the contingency theory states that there is no one best way to manage, and at the same time that any way to manage is not necessarily suitable. I guess that's a bit confusing. Basically, yeah, there isn't a single best way, but also whichever way doesn't work either. So you have to find what fits best with the environment that the company is operating in.
Exactly. I just want to add that besides this move towards a more heterogeneous, if you will, view of how management should take place, we also have a shift towards what is known as open systems. Because here we are looking both inside the organizations, how they function, but with an eye towards the outside, as Dimitris was saying, towards the environment. And that marks a very important shift in organizational theory.
Which is
taking account of what is outside the organization.
Yeah, so that's not strictly looking within the organization. It now matters how you relate to the environment.
Yeah.
I mean, the environment has been recognized throughout a number of works that we looked at. For instance, Bernard, whom we covered in episodes 7 and 8, he didn't go into the environment as explicitly, but he did, as you recall, state that organizations are unstable and that they seek to survive at all costs. Mm-hmm. And similarly, when we did episode 4 with Katharina Dittrich on March and Simon and routines, the whole thing about performance programs, it has to do with getting to grips with the environment and adopting and surviving.
Mark and Simon, they are already part of the open systems, I would say, perspective. But the interesting thing here in Lawrence and Lorsch is that the environment is broken down and is more specific, if you will. So he talks explicitly about the market or the scientific field or technological one. So, you know, the environment is not just this amorphous thing, but has a specific, you know, I'll say...
attributes?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and they actually are differentiated, right? So it's not this general kind of environment. It's attributes and are differentiated attributes that subsystems within the organization will likely see different environments depending on what their goals, orientations are, and what their purpose is.
Yes.
Right. I feel that because this paper is quite heavy on the terminology, that maybe we should define some of the key terms, because all the systems and subsystems and environments and integrations and differentiations can be confusing, especially I think when listening to this rather than reading.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good point.
So,
you want me to start, or do you have some in mind?
Well, they do this starting bottom of page 3, so we could follow that it begins with the organization.
So you do that one, and I'll do a differentiation, because I didn't actually write down the organization one. I guess I should bring up the notes.
The organization they define is a system of interrelated behaviors of people who are performing a task that has been differentiated into several distinct... then they go on about the systems and subsystems. But basically, the key takeaways here are that organization is a system, and also that it consists of people who have feelings and behave in different ways. So this is a bit of a departure from the works that preceded that kind of didn't really attribute these common characteristics to human beings.
Yes. Right. And if I understand correctly, one of the things that you're saying here is that they don't take organization to be this legal entity like the corporation, but they're talking about something along the lines of a production system. So what they call, if I'm not mistaken, as it's made by a sales subsystem, the production subsystem, and the research and development subsystem, which, if you will, are the basic functions that make up of a manufacturing context.
Yes, so organization as a system is almost like a pyramid, if you will.
Yes.
Consisting of these, they have these basic subsystems that Pedro just listed, and then they have these kind of complementary or additional subsystems that deal with these basic subsystems and this whole thing. But they do emphasize that it's a system, and the system is characterized by that it is bounded. So the system has a border, and it has some kind of internal coherence and consistency and a sets of rules that make it into a system. So it's I think Niklas Luhmann defined a system as an area of environment that is simplified. So I think that applies here as well.
Yes, it applies perfectly, because to each subsystem, they link a specific sub-environment. So to the sales subsystem, we have the market sub-environment. To the production subsystem, we have the technical economic sub-environment. And to the research and development subsystem, we have the scientific sub-environment.
Following the definition of the organization, differentiation is another key term that we want to make sure the listeners are clear on. And Lawrence and Lorsch define that as the state of segmentation of the organizational system into subsystems. And then they go on to say that these tend to develop particular attributes in relation to the requirements that come from the environment. So that's very important, because there's a lot of ideas through the paper about that differentiation and segmentation. And then that flows into the next term that's important, which is integration, because that differentiation and segmentation then require the need to integrate. And they define integration as the process of achieving unity of effort among the various subsystems. So I think the common understanding of what integration is, but it's important to be clear. And then task, because each of the subsystems has various tasks that they accomplish, they define as the complete input, transformation, an output cycle, so related to the open system that Peter was discussing earlier, which involves at least design, production, and distribution of some goods or services. So I think these terms run throughout the paper, and it's important for people to understand that they, Lawrence and Lawrence, were very careful to define what they were talking about.
I think it's worth noting that differentiation, well, the main issue here that the paper is about is the balance between differentiation and integration.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But differentiation does not simply refer to division of labor, as it's, I think, very easy to presuppose. I certainly began reading it like that. Mm-hmm. And they say that because it includes behavioral attributes of people, that gives it some quality that distinguishes it from division of labor.
So yes,
I think it's more to do with some kind of bottom up rather than top down way of differentiating, but I'm not quite sure. I think we'll get there.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's an important distinction to make.
I think that it has to do that, and they say that as well in the beginning of the paper, that they're trying to get a view that starts with their organization, not as with the individuals, to construct this idea of how organizations function. And division of labor, I think, would lead us much more to this idea of the division of among people, which is no specialization and different occupational communities working in an organization. But for them, differentiation is linked exactly to the subsystems of the organization, which is a different perspective.
Yeah, yeah, they do position themselves in this way,
mm-hmm.
kind of. Although, you know, to be honest, it's a bit strange. They do say that, and the paper is clearly structured with the systems and the organizations in mind, but they do emphasize a lot these behavioral characteristics of employees, which don't really see that much of in the data, but I guess whatever.
Well, I thought that was curious too, because they talk about, as you said, behavior, but it doesn't really mm-hmm. seem to come up other than in some of the quotes they have from the companies. And it's not really explored very deeply in the paper. So I found that a little bit curious.
No, it seems more that it's concerned with behavioral outcomes when they talk about power and authority and stuff like that.
Right.
But there isn't. Because mm-hmm. behavior is somehow, at least, I don't know, about 1967. But when we talk about behavior now, it has a processual aspect to it, that it's behavior over some period of time.
I did not really capture that, but when you start saying something about, you know, the mismatch between behavior and the focus on the organizational aspect, what I thought was that what they try to do here is that they posit four attributes of organizations to understand their link with differentiation and integration, you know, how much they are present or absent in different circumstances. And they talk about degree of structure, orientation of members towards others, time orientation, and goal orientation. And besides degree of structure, all the other three are really about behavior, you know, are really about people,
right.
you know.
Right.
So it is at least peculiar that they use these measures, these metrics, that has a very individual-based focus, I would argue, but then they want to preserve this organizational level perspective.
Which I think they do well. Generally, okay. And I was very happy to see I got very excited when I read about the orientation towards time, although it didn't quite turn out to be everything I had hoped it would.
Yeah, but, true.
It's basically how long it takes to get feedback right. from the environment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is not uncommon, because a colleague here at Warwick Business School, Professor Jerry McGivern, he wrote this paper very recently about how management consultants use cycles of time in selling their services. And it's not to go too much off track, but the premise is that because they operate in 3-month cycles, that is how they sell the products as well, so that everything resets within a period of 3 months, give or take. And because that is how it's for them, that is their environment, their kind mm-hmm. of contingency. This is also the way they sell products to customers, for whom it is not necessarily in the similar time span. So that's okay. quite interesting. Did anyone have questions about what do they mean by environment? What is this mysterious beast from the magical forest that is everywhere but not really talked about anywhere?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did, because it's you read the beginning of the paper and you see they get very specific with the definitions and of what they're talking about, and yet environment they left off, and they weave it throughout the paper. And they have hints later in the paper where they talk about, Pedro mentioned already, where they talk about the scientific environment or some of these kinds of features of the subsystems. But I didn't find that very satisfying, where they sort of give you general descriptions, but I don't really know what you mean by the scientific environment, right? That's still pretty vague to me.
Yeah. Well, here on page 5, for instance, they have this section where they talk, the importance of this variability can easily be obscured by the usual approach of thinking of an organization's environment as a single entity. So they're, mm-hmm. what Pedro said, that they're discriminating between different types of environment or components.
Okay.
Here, each major subsystem was seen as coping with its respective segment of the total external environment. It was hypothesized that each subsystem would tend to develop particular attributes which would be predictably related to characteristics of its relevant external environment. Aside from being very clearly written, it seems that they still see environment as a whole,
right.
just not monolithic.
Right.
So,
my problem was not so much with the definition, and it was more about how they operationalize it. Because if I'm not mistaken, they go on and say that it's really hard to get data on the environment, and
yes.
they referred to interviews that they have done with senior leaders of the organization. So at the end of the day, what it seems to me that they're really mapping is the perception
Absolutely.
Of the
Absolutely.
Senior leaders
yeah.
of what how they're expected to behave according to the general context they are. So I don't know, I feel it's a bit shaky.
Well, it is consistent methodologically. I also got a flag there. But because how they talk about the environment, you very nicely led there, is that environment dictates development of subsystems, right? But subsystems interpret the environment.
I agree.
There's
so
a problem there.
Well, I agree. So the question is, does the environment actually exist as a thing, or is it really just what the people perceive it to be? And then because they act in ways consistent with what their perceptions are, that's a form of shaping the environment. It's not really clear. I mean, that's why. So I agree with you, Demetrius. It's like it's a kind of a recursive argument. It reminds me of what Weick talks about in the social psychology of organizing, where he basically says you really can't know. I mean, there's no real objective environment. It's what people perceive, and he calls that enacting or an enactment of the environment. And so what they're actually responding to is the enacted environment rather than the objective environment, however that would be defined. So I'm not criticizing it. I just, like you, I thought it was kind of interesting that it is this kind of recursive argument. And so I wondered a bit about that.
That's fine. But the thing with the environment, of course, is it doesn't exist as a thing in the world.
Right.
But equally, it's not purely constructed by the company, because it's not, that's the thing with systems thinking, that this is not one system or one subsystem and another subsystem, because the company is not the only thing that interacts with the environment. Environment is all the other companies and the consumers and the suppliers and the policymakers all interacting with one another. And that is what this environment is. And while, of course, interpretation of it will determine it to a degree, relative to the organization, it will not, shape it in such a way that they seem to be suggesting here. So there's still a degree of objectivity, it just needs to be acknowledged that the environment also consists of things and stuff and other people working with those things and stuff, which gives it a degree of tangibility. Is that word?
Yes.
Makes it a bit tangible,
yeah.
but still subject to a certain degree of interpretation.
Well, absolutely, because
which is of no help at all.
Yeah, we're right, because the people in the environment, they have their own perceptions, right? So it's a very, it's a bit nebulous to me, but I don't think it detracts from the the quality of the research. I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I think quality of the research is not in question here. It's more that if we're hedging so much on this environment, it would help to understand at least conceptually what it is or how one might identify. It seems to be happening here sort of organically, that you have part of the organization that deals with marketing, for instance, and then they sort of slot into the marketing environment position mm-hmm. somehow. So what if there's a... That was one of my questions. That how... What if there's a misinterpretation or a misrepresentation? There's so much invested in being differentiated in a way that goes together with the environment, that what happens if there's a mistake there?
Yeah, I agree. What if you're off? What if your perceptions aren't clear? And in fact, you see that in some modern organizations where they have some understanding of the environment based on what they've been doing for the last 10 or 15 or 20 years, and the environment has changed so much they don't even recognize it anymore. And yet they struggle to actually recognize those changes. And so that's always curious.
Yeah,
so
I think of Nokia, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They misinterpreted the environment tragically.
Right, mm-hmm. or pick research emotion, right? Yeah. They also were very late to come out with a smartphone. I was just thinking about that the other day.
Is that a BlackBerry you're referring
yes,
to?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
so they were a $5 billion company or some number around that. No, and then the revenues just evaporated. So that just going from $5 billion to hundreds of millions is just staggering. That sort of misunderstanding of the environment. In fact, they have some famous quotes by the president of Research in Motion, which was put out of the BlackBerry. He said, "Well, we think customers prefer keyboards, physical keyboards, and that's why BlackBerry was very slow to produce a smartphone. And then when they did, it was very clunky and not well received."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that happens all the time.
What Henry was talking to, Henry Mintzberg, in episode
14.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
With those Harvard Business School star graduates, and I think it was Yurov who mentioned this quote that, I guess I picked the wrong case study.
Yes, I did.
When in the case of failure.
Right.
So with that in mind, the way we speak of it, even now you said that, they misinterpreted, misread the environment. So there is a degree of thingness to the environment, that it is there and it can certainly bite back. I wish, with regards to the description of the systems of the organization, there was a bit more appreciation of environment as, something that exerts action and pressure and effort on the system, but there isn't.
You're right. They tend to treat it in the paper. Right? So I do think this is a weakness, that they tend to treat the environment as a thing that's just there to be managed and adjusted to and that sort of thing. And perhaps because they want to focus internally on what the organization is doing about it. But I, like you, felt that was less satisfying because of that.
I think it's not only that. I think, and I want to highlight some points that you both touched upon, is that at the beginning of open systems theory, it's not a very processual necessary understanding or perspective, It's a more reified idea of what is the environment and what is an organization. And I think Ralph had a great point on bringing Vike to the picture, because nowadays we read that with our processual lenses, and we are aware that sense making breaks down and there's be like these problems of understanding the environment and so on and so forth, and we have the case of Snoke. That was not the way that people talked about or theorized about the relation between organizations and their environment.
Now, you're talking make about any sense? Besides, do you mean people besides the authors or others writing about the environment and companies?
I mean, continuous theory and all the people of traditional open systems, they did not solve the environment in such processual terms. So posed the question of there might be a problem of the way people interpret the environment, because, there's the idea that almost like information processing, they are able to read it, so...
Right. A huge level of uncertainty, right? So not only about how the subsystems, match or don't match their environment or the level of complexity, but both you guys said this, right? It's the environment exerts pressure. Mm-hmm. So there's things that are changing in the environment. And yes, I get that, that you have to, it's about information and learning and that stuff, but that's not completely clear cut, like you pointed out, Petro, where mm-hmm. you can actually misperceive what's going on in the environment. So there's quite a bit to it there. So they do talk about, you know, I think one of the things they say in the paper where it's basically, I'm not sure I have a quote about it, so you guys can help me about this, but this idea that, well, if the environment, if there's a lot of uncertainty in the environment, I think we've been talking about that, and I think that would come from change and complexity and those sorts of things, then that puts a premium on information, you know, getting good information, and therefore this is this differentiation aspect so you can get better information. You know, Wyke and others talk about the concept of requisite variety, right, where you have to be as varied as the environment to, in order to collect the best information.
I think we enter here the whole idea of differentiation and why it's important. And in a way, I think it's one of the most, you know, classic things, because, you know, organizations in a way are these machines to achieve goals, and they need to break down the work in different ways, you know, in specialization and so on and so forth. And it's something that, of course, is still a challenge, because when you break down the work and you differentiate, and it's going to help you to, well, to follow your lead, Ralph, to be as varied as the environment. But then the problems happen. And I think they do a good job on describing that, you know, once you have these differences, the different parts of your organization are going to pull in different directions. They're going to develop specific goals, and then the whole problem starts.
Well, I think one thing that it's important, I think, for the listeners to know at this point, before we go too much farther, is the research question that Lawrence and Loris were addressing in their paper. So that's on page 2. And the question is, what pattern of differentiation and integration of the parts of a large organizational system is associated with the organization's coping effectively with a given external environment? So that's what they're trying to understand better through the, you know, the data and interviews that they collected.
And there are actually a few echoes to more contemporary work on organizations, such as issues of different languages, for instance.
Yes, true. Mentioned
it with regards to the problem of integration, that when the degree of differentiation is high, so, you know, when there is specialized parts of the organization, then they may find it difficult to communicate with each other. And actually, I think it's worth noting that the whole problem of integration has its roots in coordination. Right? So all these Asians, basically. But it wouldn't be an issue if the organization... This is almost poetic. So it wouldn't be an issue if the organization did not need to exert a degree of more or less central control or coordination among the different subsystems, so specializations, if you will. But since it has to do so, because they may, more often than not, at least in the plastics industry where this study has taken place, rely on one another to turn out a product, then they have to have this degree. However, if we look at some of the more of the less centralized forms of organizing, such as some kind of a cell type of organization, like, you know, even a franchise, for instance, then integration is not really that big of an issue. But that's distracting from the paper, basically, for them, because their object of study was a kind of traditional chemical manufacturing company. That's roughly located in the same place, albeit quite large. Then this is why there was a premium on finding a balance between specialized work and keeping everything within the context of a single decision-making apparatus.
Well, I was just going to say, one of the things I think is important to note about the nature of the organizations they observed, you know, some large and some small, is I think it was important that they look at the same kinds of organizations, because you see a lot of papers... They'll look at, like, across various sectors of industry. And I think it makes it difficult to draw general conclusions, at least conclusions that I find satisfying, when you go to the very high level of multiple industries. And maybe that's important for different research questions, but I thought it was important here. I'm trying to avoid saying good as if I'm reviewing it. But I thought it was important here that they picked people doing the same kind of work, because then that the comparisons across subsystems were much more, I think, effective.
We can imagine situations and organizations in which you don't need differentiation and integration, that differentiation is enough, integration is not so important. So I was thinking the case of consultants, to go back what Dimitris was saying in the beginning, you know, in which you have more product-based kind of organizing. But in situations which are more, I would say, traditional to manufacturing, and I saw that a lot in the fieldwork that I did in the aerospace industry, in which you have a very complex system and it has a lot of parts and it requires a lot of specialist work, but also the product is just one, so it has to pull all of this together. The tension is there, you know. And I was going to ask you, Ralph, if you see the same thing in HROs as well, because I think that they have a similar, they face a similar challenge in which you have
work. Do you want to unpack the HRO?
Okay, high reliability organizations?
Also known as episode 11.
Yes.
And so I think that's exactly what you see in high reliability organizations or systems of high reliability organizing. You have all these, they deal with a very complex environment on many levels, and their challenge is both this, the how to manage the flexibility or the need for centralized control, mm-hmm. because of the risks involved in the environment, with the flexibility needed for local differentiation. So I think this is very applicable to high reliability organizations.
And the other thing I was going to mention is that, following this idea of differentiation, is that that's one of the good things about reading the classics, you know. It's, they even talk about specialized language, which has been something that's been widely discussed in more contemporary studies. You know, the work of Paul Carlisle and Beth Betschke and all these people that try to understand how coordination happens across occupational communities in organizations. And they already are hinting into that in this, you know, paper like 50 years before. And if a way, it's almost like a standing challenge for organizations, because you need to create specialization, you need to create different functions. But at the same time, this runs against what the principle of most organization is, which is, you know, coordinated action, achieving coordinated goals. So I always like when you see these things in classic texts.
No, that's true. And the further very cool thing about this is that they don't just say, like Taylor did, that you need to create these the degree of differentiation because of specialist demands for labor.
Mm-hmm.
What they say, because of the whole emphasis on the environment, is that that's going to happen anyway. That because environment is not monolithic and there's different bits and pieces to it, that if you have an organization, it's going to have to specialize anyway. You know, you have marketing, you have operations, you have administration, sales, mm-hmm. whatever. That's going to emerge from the environment, whether mm-hmm. you design it into the organization or not. And that's, I think that's a technical yet significant aspect of one of the things that they're saying here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right. I think it's important. It emerges, right, as opposed to having to be by conscious design.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. almost like within institutional theory, they have this concept of isomorphism,
mm-hmm.
that organizations tend to get more alike rather than more
right.
different. This certainly has explanatory value with regards to that as well.
You know? Well, I actually disagree vehemently with this whole isomorphism thing of institutional theory, but let's not go there.
Wait to future text.
Yeah. When we discuss institutional theory, we'll bring that up in a future episode.
All right, there we go.
But there is a parallel here. I mean, you must agree.
No, I know. But for me, institutional theory, they have exactly this amorphous idea of the environment. That's the problem. You know, so they see it from far away. They never define it. It's never very clear who is there. So hence, they have like this very, you know, wobbly, I think sometimes, claims. But
so basically like here.
Yes.
Yeah. There you go. So if you're an institutional theorist and you disagree, please get in touch.
Yes.
And yes.
Moving forward with the work, what Lawrence and Lorsch do here is that they selected three sub-environments, which is, you know, the specialist part of the environment,
mm-hmm.
The science, market, and technical economic. And then they took those three attributes, the certainty of information, the rate of change, and time span of definitive feedback that Pedro alluded to earlier, and they ranked them against one another by means of interviews that we also covered. And what they found is that, I don't know how much detail we should go into here, but basically the science sub-environment had least certain information, had a kind of uncertain rate of change, and had a very long time span in feedback. Mm-hmm. The market one was medium certain, a bit same, similar rate of change and medium time span of defensive feedback, and the technical economic, which I think had to do more with the kind of mechanics of things, mm-hmm. Had very certain information available, mm-hmm. had a very quick rate of change, because they mentioned the technology was evolving very rapidly mm-hmm. in those days in those companies. So the technology that has to do with producing plastics, that what the business was about. And the definitive feedback time span was also very, very short. So mm-hmm. this will be important later, because as they go on to compare the six organizations that they studied, mm-hmm. and they will be drawing on these characteristics, so that for them science is basically long-term, it doesn't change much because it's dealing with these abstract issues. Markets are also relatively stable for that mm-hmm. product, but technology is advancing rapidly. So mm-hmm. one of the key concerns for the organizations was keeping up with the technology, essentially, that yeah. I guess in the 60s, the plastics industry was rapidly evolving, you know, how they make stuff, which is kind of reminiscent of all the bright furniture and right. things that you see in Ralph.
Yeah, right. Like you see in museums of design and that sort of stuff. It's mm-hmm. I think I went to one in Germany, and it was I was very young in the early 60s. So you see some of that stuff on TV, but for the viewers, go look at 2001: A Space Odyssey, and they have all this, you know, futuristic plastic like furniture. So
mm-hmm. yeah. So I just want to compliment what Dimitri was saying, that they think that they do, once they establish these environments or sub environments actually. They go and they intermesh that with the four attributes that they say to be constitutive of the way organizations are run, which is structure, interpersonal orientation, time orientation, and goal orientation. And pretty much most of their hypotheses that they put forward are sustained with the data from the six organizations. So we have things like in production, some environments, structure tends to be much more stringent. The same thing for time orientation, you know, like in sales situations, you have shorter time spans when compared to research in some environments, subsystems, I mean. So I think it corroborates the idea that depending on how their sub-environment is structured, it's going to feedback in the way the subsystem operates within organizations.
Right, and I guess this is one of the examples where we actually see how they arrive at some kind of metrics of the sub-environments. So mm-hmm. we have that 3x3 table, essentially.
Yes.
Which I guess we will not go too much into.
2x2 or 3x3? I got...
It's 3x3, the science market
technology
versus those. And then, as you said, the structure... orientation towards each other, time, and what was the last one?
3x4.
Yeah, then that gets juxtaposed on these yeah. metrics. It's very quantitative in yes. places, mm-hmm. kind of pseudo-quantitative almost.
Yeah, I would say, because a lot of it's the quantitative is based on subjective and qualitative assessment. So,
well, as it is generally, but here I guess more mm-hmm. so transparently than when you look at more. But yeah, I mean, I like quantitative studies to a degree, mm-hmm. but here it very nicely shows what kind of assumptions go into arriving at the quants.
That's very good. Yeah. They were very clear about that.
They do say that, you know, these numbers are kind of ballpark.
Yeah, they say crude estimate.
Yes, crude estimate. So they're not, you know, they're not making any claims as to exact mm-hmm. science of it,
right.
which is good. Yeah.
Should we talk about the other part of the paper, which I think that's actually a different paper when they talk about how integration is achieved, or differentiation integration, but specifically integration devices?
I'm glad that you mentioned that it's a different paper, because that was very much my impression as well. The first part is one very voluminous thing where they sort of lay down the foundations and determine some of the environments. And then the second part, which I guess we'll mainly discuss in the second part of our episode, has more to do with the actual practicalities of it. And for my money, it's a bit more interesting.
I'm the same. I thought the second part was more interesting. I didn't perceive it as two papers like you two did when I was reading it, but now I see what you're talking about. And I did notice that difference. And I particularly liked it. I realized the first part, they have to set up the definitions and get some of the rankings and crude estimates. So I recognized it was necessary, but I was very interested in the interviews they did and the excerpts they gave from interviews. And and they're talking about how people, particularly the parts about integration and power and those kinds of things, I thought was very interesting.
From my reading, what came through the paper was that in doing the research, it seems almost that they figured out that was a different subsystem in a way in organizations, which is the one that is in charge of assuring integration, making sure that all this subsystem work together well, which you can almost call an integration subsystem. And that's what they explore. They call it integrative devices. And that's exactly what they explore in the second part of the paper.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it does get a bit confusing with the subsystems acting on other subsystems within a system that has to do with sub-environments of the environment.
Right. And then they go into the whole how the integration happens, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah. But in this part, they introduced the key things, including kind of the role of the environment and how they measure it, and also what are the key metrics that they will later use in part 2.
And that's all for part 1 of episode 16. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with part 2, where we go more into depth with the empirical bit of the paper. Meanwhile, if you like this episode and you like the podcast, please get in touch and tell us what you think. Share the podcast with your friends, colleagues, and students. And just generally enjoy talking about organizations, both with us and amongst each other. And we hope to see you next week as we finish this discussion about this amazing paper here on Talking About Organizations.